I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is author of short fiction, novels, comic books, and films, Neil Gaiman. He's joined in conversation by author Michael Chabon. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Neil Gaiman and Michael Chabon.
So, who is Neil Gaiman? Not only is he the prolific, multi-award-winning author of comics galore, novels, short stories, radio plays, screenplays, essays, poems, and song lyrics for audiences of all ages, he's married to a rock star who he sometimes performs with. All of this has helped to spread his unique talent of wordsmithing to the small corners of the globe, and it really wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that he is truly one of the most beloved authors on the planet. Neil's latest book is his third collection of short fiction, Trigger Warning, which includes a never-before-published American God story, Black God, written exclusively for this volume. Appearing in conversation with Neil this evening is Michael Chabon, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of novels, essays, and screenplays, including The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Cavalier and Clay, The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Spider-Man 2, and Telegraph Avenue. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, please make Neil Gaiman and Michael Chabon very welcome to the JCCSF.
Hello. Hello.
So, anyway, it's really fun to be here, and I'm glad to be doing this, and this is a great place to be doing this.
It is.
As much fun as it is, it's also a sad day. It's a sad day for the literary community. We've lost a wonderful, delightful, important writer, Terry Pratchett. And I know Terry Pratchett was a good friend and collaborator of yours, and more than either of those words can really convey. So I was hoping maybe you just might want to start out just by telling us about Terry and why he was important to you and why he is important to all of us, or ought to be.
So, it was a horrible morning. I woke up and I was cleaning my teeth, and Amanda came in and just started hugging me, which she normally doesn't do when I'm cleaning my teeth. And then she said, "Do you want to come and sit on the bed?" And I said, "Sure," because I couldn't think of any reason not to come and sit on the bed when asked by somebody who had hugged me all the way through a very long tooth cleaning. And I sat down, and she said, "Terry passed away in the night." And I was so pleased that she was the one of us who had gone onto her phone first and seen the news, and I got to hear it from a human being. Terry Pratchett. Sir Terry Pratchett. I met Terry 30 years and 1 month ago in a Chinese restaurant in London. And he had one novel out at that point called The Color of Magic and had not yet published The Light Fantastic, the sequel. And I was a journalist and I was asked to go and interview him for a magazine called Space Voyager. And who was such a small magazine that they asked me if I could take a camera and take photographs of Terry, which I did. So somewhere I have the world's worst photographs of Terry. But it was that weird thing where you sit down with somebody and you realize that the Venn diagrams of your minds overlap. Mm-hmm. You share headspace. And I remember at one point we just wandered onto jokes about forbidden books. For, we both had heads that had taken us to the point where we decided there should be a forbidden book that was a phone book. And Terry had come up with the Necrotelecomnicom. And I had come up with the Liber Fulvarum Paginarum, or the Book of Yellow Colored Pages. And it was like, okay, we had the same kind of heads. It was sitting there going, oh my gosh, you're one of me too. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there was another one around. So in the years that followed, we would have the kind of conversations where Terry would say to me things like, so I'm done with the Discworld, and now I'm going to do this big science fiction series. I've come up with it, and this is the plot of the science fiction series, and he'd tell me all about it. And get to the end, and I'd say, well, that's all very well, but I think you should do a book about death. And then a week later, my phone would ring, and I'd pick it up, and a voice would say, you bastard, it's called Mort. And he'd put the phone and it was in those strange early days before computers could talk to each other, mm-hmm. when we had computers, but they didn't talk. And so very often, my phone would ring, and Terry would say, yeah, what's funnier? And he'd throw two things at me. And I'd listen to them. I'd say, what's funnier? Is it funnier if somebody's brought up by dwarfs and doesn't notice they're ridiculously tall? Or is it funnier if they're a lost prince and they never notice they're the lost prince? And I'd say, well, you know you could do both. Most of our conversations were me saying, you know, you could do both. And him saying, how? So we do those kind of things. Somewhere in there, I wrote a book called Don't Panic, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Companion, which was written in that kind of classic English humor style. Mm-hmm. And when I got to the end of it, I thought, I could do that. And I sat down, I had an idea for something that combined this ridiculous English series of children's books called the William books with The Omen, the plot of The Omen. And in my head it was going to be called William the Antichrist. And I wrote the first 5,000 pages. Let's try that again. I wrote the first... Okay. I did not. I
was fast, very but not. Small
I wrote the first 5,000 words. Uh-huh. There we go. The first, which would have been the first, I don't know, what's 5,000 words? 30 pages?
Like, yeah, not quite. Yeah.
25 pages. Mm. And I sent it off to a few friends. I posted it and said, look, this is this thing that I think I'm doing. And then Sandman happened. So suddenly, my entire life became writing Sandman. And one day, the phone rings, and a voice at the other end says, "Ear, that thing you sent me, you doing anything with that?" Mm. And I said, well, no, I'm not. I'm writing Sandman and Books of Magic and all of this other stuff. And he said, well, tell you what, either sell me the idea and that opening, or we can write it together. Mm. Because I want to find out what happens next. And I said, we are going to write it together. Because I am not stupid. And I'm going, this is rather like... You know, the analogy that I've got it to at this point is just... I've said it's a lot like Michelangelo phoning you up and saying, you know, do you want to paint a ceiling together? Mm-hmm. You go... Here is somebody who really knows his craft. He is an absolute craftsman. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to write a novel with him is one... This is the equivalent of the ultimate MFA. Mm-hmm. So I said yes. And at that point, I was still writing Sandman and still writing Books of Magic. So normally about 2 o'clock in the morning... I would get out of whatever document I was in and go over to Good Omens, and I would write Good Omens until about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. Then I'd go to sleep. I'd wake up about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and my answering machine, the little red light would be flashing. Back before we had the kind of things we have now.
You should mention.
You had these machines. They would sit there. They actually had tapes.
As big as a bus.
They were. Yeah. Many of them were buses.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had tapes, and you would press a button, and the tape would go all the way back before you could find out. This was so long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Before you could find out the message that somebody had for you, which they hadn't even texted you. You had to listen to it in words. So, Terry, the words would go, get up, you bastard, I've just written a good bit.
Had you divided the sections, or was there email yet?
There was no email.
Mm-hmm.
What we would do was we would talk plot on the phone each day for maybe an hour, hour and a half, make each other laugh, mm-hmm. come up with great gags, talk about what we were going to do next, and then it was a mad dash to get to the next good bit before the other one could.
Mm.
So Terry would still be on section A, and I would say, okay, well, I'll go and do this then.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of divided characters.
Mm.
But then as we got toward the end of the book, we started handing bits back so that by the end we had each written every character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to begin with, I was doing all the Four Horsemen stuff, for example. So the Four Horsemen are mine until they get to the aerodrome,
mm-hmm.
when I give them to Terry.
Mm-hmm.
The kids were mostly Terry until they set off for the aerodrome, at which point they become mine.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, then we'd go in and start footnoting each other's bits,
mm-hmm.
or just adding gags mm-hmm. to each other's bits.
Mm-hmm.
The section, I want to read a bit of Good Omens tonight, and I haven't... I haven't actually read any of Good Omens in front of an audience since probably 1990, when Terry and I were on tour.
Mm.
That
was a long time ago.
So, 25 years. And what I liked about this section, well, you'll see what I liked about this section. But I did the first draft on this. Terry did the second, and some of my favorite jokes and lines are his. But also, it's because of where it goes. It was very early on Saturday morning, on the last day of the world, and the sky was redder than blood. The International Express delivery man rounded the corner at a careful 35 miles an hour, shifted down to second, and pulled up on the grass verge. He got out of the van and immediately threw himself into a ditch to avoid an oncoming lorry that had barreled around the bend at something well in excess of 80 miles an hour. He got up, picked up his glasses, put them back on, retrieved his parcel and clipboard, brushed the grass and mud from his uniform, and, as an afterthought, shook his fist at the rapidly diminishing lorry. Shouldn't be allowed, bloody lorries. No respect for the other road users. What I always say, is remember that without a car, son, you're just a pedestrian too. He climbed down the grassy verge, clambered over a low fence, and found himself beside the River Uck. The International Express delivery man walked along the banks of the river, holding the parcel. Farther down the riverbank sat a young man dressed all in white. He was the only person in sight. His hair was white, his skin chalk pale, and he sat and stared up and down the river as if he were admiring the view. He looked like how Victorian romantic poets looked just before the consumption and drug abuse really started to cut. The International Express man couldn't understand it. I mean, in the old days, and it wasn't that long ago, really, there'd been an angler every dozen yards along the bank. Children had played there. Courting couples had come to listen to the splish and gurgle of the river and to hold hands and get all lovey-dovey in the Sussex sunset. He'd done that with Maud, his missus, before they were married. They'd come here to spoon. And on one memorable occasion... Times changed, reflected the delivery man. Now white and brown sculptures of foam and sludge drifted serenely down the river, often covering it for yards at a stretch. And where the surface of the water was visible, it was covered with a molecules-thin petrochemical sheen. There was a loud whirring as a couple of geese, thankful to be back in England again after the long, exhausting flight across the northern Atlantic, landed on the rainbow-slicked water and sank without trace. Funny old world, thought the delivery man. Here's the Uck, used to be the prettiest river in this part of the world, and now it's just a glorified industrial sewer. The swans sink to the bottom, and the fishes float on the top. Well, that's progress for you. You can't stop progress. He'd reached the man in white. Excuse me, sir, party name of Chalky? The man in white nodded, said nothing. He continued to gaze out at the river, following an impressive sludge and foam sculpture with his eyes. So beautiful, he whispered. It's all so damn beautiful. The delivery man found himself temporarily devoid of words. Then his automatic systems cut in. Funny old world, isn't it? And no mistake, I mean, you go all over the world delivering, and then here you are practically in your own home, so to speak. I mean, I was born and bred round here, sir, and I've been to the Mediterranean, to Des Moines, and that's in America, sir. And now here I am, and here's your parcel, sir. Party name of Chalky took the parcel and took the clipboard and signed for the parcel. The pen developed a leak as he did so, and his signature obliterated itself as it was written. There was a long, it was a long word, and it began with a P, and then there was a splodge, and then it ended in something that might have been ence, and might have been ocean. Much obliged, sir, said the delivery man. He walked back along the river, back toward the busy road where he left his van, trying not to look at the river as he went. Behind him, the man in white opened the parcel. In it was a crown, a circlet of white metal set with diamonds. He gazed at it for some seconds with satisfaction, then put it on. It glinted in the light of the rising sun. Then the tarnish, which had begun to suffuse its silver surface when his fingers touched it, spread to cover it completely, and the crown went black. White stood up. There's one thing you can say for air pollution. You get utterly amazing sunrises. It looked like someone had set fire to the sky. And a careless match would have set fire to the river. But alas, there was no time for that now. In his mind, he knew where the four of them would be meeting and when, and he was going to have to hurry to be there by this afternoon. Perhaps we will set fire to the sky, he thought. And he left that place almost imperceptibly. It was nearly time. The delivery man had left his van on the grass verge by the dual carriageway. He walked around to the driver's side carefully because other cars and lorries were still rocketing round the bend, reached in through the open window and took the schedule from the dashboard. Only one more delivery to make then. He read the instructions on the delivery voucher carefully. He read them again, paying particular attention to the address and the message. The address was one word. Everywhere.
You're listening to author of short fiction, novels, comic books, and films, Neil Gaiman. He's joined in conversation by author Michael Chabon on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Then with his leaking pen, he wrote a brief note to Maud, his wife. It read simply, "I love you." Then he put the schedule back on the dashboard, looked left, looked right, looked left again, and began to walk purposefully across the road. He was halfway across when a German juggernaut came around the corner, its driver crazed on caffeine, little white pills, and EEC transport regulations. He watched its receding bulk. "Core," he thought, "that one nearly had me." Then he looked down at the gutter. "Oh," he thought. "Yes," agreed a voice from behind his left shoulder, or at least from behind the memory of his left shoulder. The delivery man turned and looked and saw. At first he couldn't find the words, couldn't find anything, and then the habits of a working lifetime took over, and he said, "Message for you, sir." "For me?" "Yes, sir." He wished he still had a throat. He could have swallowed if he had a throat. "No package, I'm afraid, Mr. Sir. It's a message." "Deliver it, then." "It's this, sir. Come and see." "Finally." There was a grin on its face, but then, given the face, there couldn't have been anything else. "Thank you," it continued. "I must commend your devotion to duty." "Sir?" The late delivery man was falling through a grey mist, and all he could see were two spots of blue that might have been eyes and might have been distant stars. "Don't think of it as dying," said Death. "Just think of it as leaving early to avoid the rush." The delivery man had a brief moment to wonder whether his new companion was making a joke, and to decide that he wasn't. And then there was nothing.
So, in that passage in this book, in many of his books, one you mentioned in particular, and in much of your work as well, in very overt ways sometimes, both Terry and you have written about death in its various incarnations.
I remember Terry once calling me and saying, "I'm on novel number," whatever it was, Discworld novel at that point, 5 or 6. He said, "And I've just started it with death taking somebody, and I've started most of them like that." He said, "I should stop, shouldn't I?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because at this point, it's like a P.G. Wodehouse novel. It's absolutely fine for it to begin with Jeeves coming in and seeing Bertie Wooster's new bow tie, mm-hmm. or his ukulele, or the moustache that he has just proudly grown, and disapproving of it. And you know the last thing in the novel, after Jeeves has solved the problem, is Bertie is going to shave off his moustache, mm-hmm. give back the tie, give the tie to Jeeves to destroy, mm-hmm. or the ukulele for him to give to a small child. Mm-hmm. That has to happen." Mm-hmm. I said, and you don't greet it as, "Oh, God, P.G. Wodehouse is doing that." You greet it as, "Oh, good, this is the familiar strain of a glorious beginning. Mm-hmm. We know where we are." I said, "And at this point, you starting a book with death taking somebody is a wonderful way to begin."
Mm-hmm. Sometimes this time that we're living in culturally and have been for a while is often described as being, you know, the age of the mashup, of sampling, pastiche. There's a sense of belatedness often, or that we're sort of coming at the end of something, so that what becomes possible is always going to involve, to a certain degree, working with our knowledge and the reader's knowledge, or the audience's knowledge of the things that we are using and we're chopping up and we're reassembling and to make something new out of them, so that you have lots of references and in jokes or Easter eggs or whatever you might want to call it. But that somehow there's
nothing new, really, and there's just this is what we have now, in a sense that. Do you, and you know, as someone...
As I listen to you talk, I'm going, I bet somebody said this to Shakespeare. You know. Come on, Bill. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff you've mm-hmm. done, you're just taking other people's right. stories,
all
a couple of
Holland
histories.
Shed and, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, Bill.
Mm-hmm. You nicked that.
We are in the end times, uh-huh. aren't we? What, uh-huh. I think, I like to think that we are in a time of confluence. Not the end time, but a time where streams run together. Mm. And that, for me, even as far back as the early 80s, I remember looking around and going, it is time for confluence. It's time. Right now, we have all these strict demarcation lines, I thought back then, between science fiction and fantasy and horror and the mainstream and detective fiction and romance and pornography and cookbooks and all of these things. And I'm going, I'm not sure that this is going to keep being, everything is going to stay in its little cubbyhole. I think as you get generations of writers who grow up going, well, I like all of this stuff. Why can't I have all of this?
Pornographic cookbooks, for example.
I think there should be more pornographic cookbooks.
So that instead of this idea that somehow it's a bunch of broken pieces of these great statues that are all lying around us, and all you can do now is sort of pick up the pieces and try to make your own freakish.
I think it's much more like fusion cuisine. Mm-hmm. It's that point where you go, okay, there is actually no reason why I can't combine this food and this food mm-hmm. to create a taste that nobody's actually ever had before. But once you've had it, you're going, well, of course, this makes complete sense.
Right.
On the other hand, do not try.
I have my own
Several
example.
Several nights ago, I was in Oklahoma City. And I was taken to one of the few places that serves food at midnight, because my plane got in very, very late, Oklahoma City. And and we ordered a few of these interesting starters, and the waitress came out and she said, you know, we're out of whatever it was you ordered. Would you like something else? And we said, well, sure. What else is interesting on there? And she said, well, actually, the only thing that we have left is the pickled peaches. So we went, okay, bring the pickled peaches.
And could be good.
These things arrived, and I tasted them. And my friend Scott tasted them, and we were both... Well, I said, that's not a taste I've ever had before. Definitely not a taste before. And about 20 minutes later, Wayne Coyne from the Flaming Lips came over, and it was Wayne, and Wayne was the one who'd suggested that we eat there. And he's like, so, he said, I should have told you, don't order the food here except for like three things on the menu that are edible. What's that? And I said, that's pickled peaches. Actually, I think we made him guess first. It was like, I said, he said, what are they like? I said, not like anything else I've ever eaten. So he tried one. He said, that's not like anything else I've ever eaten. And he called the waitress over, which I wouldn't have done because I'm English. Mm. But he had no hesitation. He said, excuse me. That pickled peaches. And she said, it wasn't my idea. They were not I told them they should try the collard greens, but he said, no, no, no. He said, what's the deal with it? Mm-hmm. And she said, the chef's over there. And before we can say anything else, she brings over the chef. And she says, they want to know what the deal is with the pickled peaches. And he says, well, I put in radishes, first of all, and it's pickled peaches cooked with radishes. So I pickle the peaches in there with radishes, and the hotness comes out of the radishes, and it goes into the peaches, and they're sort of pickled, so you get that weird thing. He said, and then I add a lot of salt to make sure that anyone who eats it orders drinks. And I said, does it work? He said, how do you mean? I said, Has anyone ever ordered it twice? And there was a long pause. He said, I don't think so. And I said, have you ever tried it? He said, I don't like that kind of thing.
Oh, my God.
And so I want you to know, somewhere... Anyway, that was more just the idea that sometimes ambitious fusion cooking can go desperately wrong.
But no, I mean, on the other hand, so that there's that, and then there's the Korean taco, which is one of the greatest food items ever devised by humanity.
That, for me, and also for me, I guess part of it is just the idea that nothing is off limits. And there are places, I mean, in Trigger Warning, there are absolutely places where I've gone and played old tunes.
Deliberately, like you're evoking a tradition, let's say, of the club story or something
absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely, right? Or a Sherlock Holmes story. Mm-hmm. I get to write a Sherlock Holmes story. But in each case, as far as I'm concerned, actually, let me use an analogy that Terry came up with. Terry was saying to me once, he said, when you're a writer, you're a young writer, it's like all of literature is a stew. It's a big bubbling pot of stew. And you go over and you ladle out something and you eat the stew. So that's what you're doing in the beginning as a young writer. You're taking everything that's been there before. He said, what's nice is the idea that once you've been doing it for a while, you're starting to throw things back into the stew. You drop in a potato that's never been there before, or a carrot. So with each of those things, even if I was doing a club story, even if I was doing a Sherlock Holmes story, I'd always try and, at the end, let it go back into the stew with a little bit more, with something in people's heads. The idea that they could take it and it wasn't a dead end, it wasn't a broken lump of stature, it wasn't something at the end of something. Instead, it somehow is a door. I love the idea that people could read A Case of Death and Honey and go, wow, that lets you take Holmes and Watson off here. You could do that and take him off there. And that they're being used for something, you know, essentially it's a little essay about mortality that at the same time tries to answer a question that had puzzled me since I was about 9 years old, which was simply, we know that Holmes is almost catatonic if he does not have a case. If he is not working on a case, he is on borderline breakdown. He must have a case that he is working on.
Lest he turn to the cocaine.
Well, he's going to turn to the cocaine, but it's also, he breaks down. It doesn't, he turns to cocaine to try and turn his mind off because he does not work unless he's working on a case. He becomes incredibly depressed. He becomes, you know, essentially clinically depressed. And whether he's trying to medicate himself or not, he's still absolutely messed up. He's not alive, Conan Doyle says at one point, unless he has a case. So how do we explain retiring and keeping bees? And I'm a beekeeper. And as a beekeeper, I can assure you, most of what you do if you keep bees is nothing. You are not up at dawn every day lining the bees up and polishing them. counting them. Making sure they're doing something. Saying, all right, you lot out there, we got flowers. You are not doing that. You are basically, if you are keeping bees on the South Downs, most of the time you're doing nothing. Maybe you're going to check them every couple of weeks. They're in high harvest season. You're in harvest. And when you're harvesting them, you're going to work very hard. But mostly, you are leaving them alone. That is the successful beekeeper. You leave your bees alone, and then you do what has to be done. So I thought, It doesn't make sense. He must have been working on something. The bees, the beehives must have been a case. Mm-hmm. And that then took me into
a wonderful story. One of my favorite of all post-Doyle stories, Conan Doyle stories, is that story. It's a great story. And your collection, I think, this collection reflects, it's very much a short story collection for an age in which those artificial barriers have been lifted, those dams have been broken down, and this confluence has occurred, because as you sort of, in your wonderful introduction, you almost apologize.
I do apologize.
I mean, you're English, so we kind of expect that, but... Yeah. You know, for the fact that I think you say something like, you know, a short story collection ought to present a certain, not uniformity, but a certain thematic unity, yeah. And or some kind of unity, and this one is more of a grab bag. It's a this kind of story, that kind of story. But
what I love, though, is, and I firmly believed that when I wrote it, and I firmly believe it now, but what I love is people who've been coming up to me and saying, but that's not true. There are all of these themes that you can see running through the whole thing, and they run through everything in there. And, you know, you must have known that when you were putting it together. And I'm sort of going, well, really, as far as I was concerned, the theme was, what have I written since 2007?
Exactly. Or how am I going to pay for that orthodontia bill? Mm-hmm.
The lovely thing about short story collections, at least for me, is until this one, it had never occurred to me that they were things that could pay orthodontic bills. You know, they are things that publishers have a wonderful attitude, which is they can make you feel that they are doing you a favor sometimes. You must have experienced this. It's like
every now and then,
you know,
certain magazines.
What they want is
published in New York.
But publishers, I'm thinking particularly book publishers, what they really would like is a novel. Mm-hmm. They really like a nice, thick novel from you. They'll publish other things because they like you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to keep you encouraged and happy until you hand in a nice, thick novel. The weirdness of Trigger Warning is that it's now in week 5 on the New York Times list, and they're sort of all going, so, real book?
Going, right.
Yeah, apparently. Which is rather, rather wonderful.
So, Trigger Warnings. I don't know what to think about them. Will you tell me what to think?
No, I can't tell you what to think and don't want to tell you what to think. I can tell you
Please.
What I think.
Okay.
And what
and I'll
I
just think that.
And also what I wanted to do, but what I really wanted to do with the title was get people talking. Mm-hmm. I've seen occasionally people getting really upset with me and saying, well, Gaiman has obviously picked an edgy title. As if, I'm going, we don't have a history of picking edgy titles. You might want to actually believe what I say in the introduction about why I picked it as a title, which is mostly the idea of getting people to talk, the idea of moving this as a discussion. Because when I first ran across Trigger Warnings online, I thought, what a great idea. Mm-hmm. And I think online trigger warnings are a fantastic idea. The idea that, especially in a situation where you do not know what's going to be coming across your screen, to let people know that material that could profoundly upset them, could deeply trigger them, that could throw them into traumatic... that is a good thing. Mm-hmm. The web is filled with images I wish I had never seen and content I wish I had never read. Mm-hmm. Warning people about it is a great thing. And then there was this weird kind of idea trickle where people suddenly started saying things like, university classrooms should be safe spaces. I'm going, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Therefore, classic books, films, what you read should all have trigger warnings on it in case it triggers people's post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. in case people get through. Mm-hmm. I'm going, well, No, I'm not sure I can go there with you. I don't believe that a classroom is the correct place to treat post-traumatic stress disorder.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features author of short fiction, novels, comic books, and films, Neil Gaiman. He's joined in conversation by author Michael Chabon. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
At the point where you're starting to put trigger warnings on Hamlet, mm-hmm. warning about suicide mm-hmm. and murder mm-hmm. and insanity, at the point where you're putting trigger warnings on Titus Andronicus, mm-hmm. warning of the things that are in Titus Andronicus. Mm-hmm. Warning contains pies. I'm going, I don't think that's right. Okay, why don't I think that's right? Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, well, when we did Sandman, we used to put a recommended for mature readers mm-hmm. tag on. And I liked that. It didn't define, it didn't have an age group on mm-hmm. it. It didn't say recommended for 18. No, it just said recommended for mature readers. Mm-hmm. I've met mature readers who were 14. I've met people who are definitely not mature readers in their 30s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I thought, good, they're not ready for Sandman. Mm-hmm. I liked the idea that... And then I started thinking, okay, should people... Once you get into actual fiction, what kind of warnings should people be given? Mm-hmm. What are the differences between trigger warnings and spoilers in this case? Mm-hmm. To what extent... How about me? You know, there are places where I would much rather not go. And there are definitely places that I can think of where, particularly as a child, I found myself absolutely out of my depth. Mm-hmm. In stories that were, you know, I remember a story about androids called, I think, Made in America. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the author. Not a particularly great science fiction story, but at one point in it, a character is raped. An android girl is raped. And I had no idea what was going on other than she was being forced at knife point to take her clothes off. And as far as I was concerned, as a 9-year-old, 10-year-old, that was the worst thing mm-hmm. that could happen to you. If you were taking your clothes off, you were absolutely vulnerable and at knife point. And this was... horrible, and I didn't know people could behave like that. And it was one of those stories that it was so deeply upsetting to mm-hmm. me. There was another one called The Harlem Horror by a man called Charles Birkin. And I went and looked him up the other day on Wikipedia and discovered he was actually a lord in the English House of Lords who wrote this monstrous story for me when I read it at a very young age called The Harlem Horror about a couple... whose daughter disappeared, whose child was kidnapped, and they go to a freak show, and there is a creature in the freak show with one huge golden eye, barely human, its mouth is destroyed, it can't talk, but when it sees them, it gets agitated, and it's reaching for them, and it seems to be crying. And later, they find an article... a newspaper thing about a doctor, a mad doctor, who's been kidnapping children and mutilating them and selling them to freak shows as monsters. And the man lies to his wife and says, no, 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 I know that our daughter actually died and I didn't tell you about it. Mm. And reading this story, it was just like, you mean adults, that could happen? And if I was kidnapped and this could happen to me? And it just was horrible. Both stories that I wish I'd never read mm-hmm. and wish I hadn't read at that age. And also stories that I now look back and I go, what did that do? What did that do to the inside of my head? Do I really wish I'd never read them? These things that haunted my nightmares, mm-hmm. that you know, I would, places that I would never willingly go back, that I can tell you the plots of 40-something years later and have not gone back and reread that upset me. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I am glad I read them. Mm-hmm.
There's power.
There is power in there, and it's power that I take and try and pass on mm-hmm. in literature, because literature does have power. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, it's a really weird and fascinating problem. Should literature be safe? Mm-hmm. Should books be safe mm-hmm. places? I've had people come up to me and say, I don't know why you called it trigger warning. Everything in there is so lovely and warm. And I've had people come up to me and say, oh my God, I could see why you call it trigger warning. I read, and they'll talk to me about a story that gave them nightmares and really upset them. And they were sitting there reading with tears running down their face. And I think, but that was one of the innocuous ones. Mm-hmm. That was mm-hmm. a sweet one. Why mm-hmm. would you?
Right. It just also reminds me too, when Rosie, my almost 14-year-old, about a year ago, told Sophie, who's 20, that she wanted to read the Sandman books, and she said, Sophie, weren't you about my age when you read them? And Sophie said, yes, but it was too soon.
You know, which is also true and fair for mm-hmm. some people, and it is that thing where I had this conversation a few days ago with a 14-year-old fan, mm-hmm. and she was telling me what she'd read, mm-hmm. and asked what she should read next. And I said, probably Neverwhere. Mm-hmm. I said, and then read this, and then read that. And I said, you know, with American Gods, wait until you're 16 or mm-hmm. 17. Mm-hmm. Just give it a little mm-hmm. time. It'll work better. Mm-hmm. For various reasons.
And, you know, that's why we have independent bookstores and librarians to make those kind of recommendations and not warnings and prohibitions. Well, so before, as a way of closing and of saying goodnight to everyone, will you read us a little story?
I will. I thought I should read something by me.
Not by Douglas Adams.
Well, not by me and Terry. It's been a weird. The last few days, I've been going around and doing things in different places. And a couple of nights ago, I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I got to read an R.A. Lafferty story to an audience of 2,300 people from and around Tulsa, most of whom had never heard of Lafferty, who was a Tulsa author.
Will you tell us, and in case we don't know who
R.A. Lafferty? Was the wisest, weirdest, funniest, strangest writer of science fiction, or whatever the it was he was writing, mm-hmm. From about 1960 until really the late 80s when he stopped writing. And a remarkable writer, somebody whose work I loved since I was a kid. And I got to announce in Tulsa that in his centenary year, he'd been appointed to the Oklahoma Writers Hall of Fame. I was so proud to see that. But I got to read a story, and what was great was listening to them laugh, and all of these people going, I've got to find him. And you're going, well, mostly out of print, but that can change. This is one of the 12 short stories that I wrote in a mad social media experiment a couple of years ago of tweeting out 12 questions to the world, asking questions like, why is January dangerous? What's the strangest thing you've seen in July? Things like that. And getting all sorts of answers back. And more or less grabbing an answer at random for each month and just writing it, using it to write a short story, which I wanted to do, going back to what we were saying about Terry at the beginning, to show people that writing, there's magic involved, sure, but mostly it's a craft. You're sitting there, you do it. And this is the October tale. That feels good, I said, and I stretched my neck to get out the last of the cramp. It didn't just feel good. It felt great, actually. I'd been squashed up inside that lamp for so long. You start to think that nobody's ever going to rub it again. You're a genie, said the young lady with the polishing cloth in her hand. I am. You're a smart girl, Toots. What gave me away? The appearing in a puff of smoke, she said. And you look like a genie. You've got the turban and the pointy shoes. I folded my arms and blinked. Now I was wearing blue jeans, gray sneakers, and a faded gray sweater, the male uniform of this time and this place. I raised a hand to my forehead, and I bowed deeply. I am the genie of the lamp, I told her. Rejoice, O fortunate one. I have it in my power to grant you 3 wishes. And don't try the I wish for more wishes thing. I won't play, and you'll lose a wish. Right. Go for it. I folded my arms again. No, she said. I mean, thanks and all that, but it's fine. I'm good. Honey, I said. Toots, sweetie, perhaps you misheard me. I'm a genie. And the 3 wishes, we're talking anything you want. You ever dreamed of flying? I can give you wings. You want to be wealthy, richer than Croesus? You want power? Just say it. 3 wishes. Whatever you want. Like I said, she said, thanks. I'm fine. Would you like something to drink? You must be parched after spending so much time in that lamp. Wine? Water? Tea? Actually, now she came to mention it. I was thirsty. Do you have any mint tea? She made me some mint tea in a teapot that was almost a twin to the lamp in which I'd spent the greater part of the last 1,000 years. Thank you for the tea. No problem. But I don't get it. Everyone I've ever met, they start asking for things. A fancy house. A harem of gorgeous women. Not that you'd want that, of course. I might, she said. You can't just make assumptions about people. Oh, and don't call me Toots or Sweetie or any of those things. My name's Hazel. Ah, I understood. You want a beautiful woman then? My apologies, you have but to wish. I folded my arms. No, she said, I'm good. No wishes. How's the tea? I told her that the mint tea was the finest I had ever tasted. She asked me when I had started feeling a need to grant people's wishes. And whether I felt a desperate need to please. She asked about my mother. And I told her that she could not judge me as she would judge mortals, for I was a djinn, powerful and wise, magical and mysterious. She asked me if I liked hummus. And when I said that I did, she toasted a pita bread and sliced it up for me to dip into the hummus. I dipped my bread slices into the hummus and ate it with delight. The hummus gave me an idea. Just make a wish, I said helpfully, and I could have a meal fit for a sultan brought into you. Each dish would be finer than the one before, and all served upon golden plates. And you could keep the plates afterwards. It's good, she said with a smile. Would you like to go for a walk? We walked together through the town. It felt good to stretch my legs after so many years in the lamp. We wound up in a public park, sitting on a bench by a lake. It was warm but gusty, and the autumn leaves fell in flurries each time the wind blew. I told Hazel about my youth as a djinn, of how we used to eavesdrop on the angels and how they would throw comets at us if they spied us listening. I told her of the bad days of the djinn wars and how King Suleiman had imprisoned us inside hollow objects, bottles, lamps, clay pots, that kind of thing. She told me of her parents, who were both killed in the same plane crash and who'd left her the house. She told me of her job, illustrating children's books, a job she'd backed into accidentally at the point she realized she would never be a really competent medical illustrator, and of how happy she became whenever she was sent a new book to illustrate. She told me she taught life drawing to adults at the local community college one evening a week. I saw no obvious flaw in her life, no hole that she could fill by wishing, save one. Your life is good, I told her, but you have no one to share it with. Wish, and I will bring you the perfect man or woman. A film star, a rich person. No need, I'm good, she said. We walked back to her house, past houses dressed for Halloween. This is not right, I told her. People always want things. Not me. I've got everything I need. Then what do I do? She thought for a moment. Then she pointed at her front yard. Can you rake the leaves? Is that your wish? Nope, just something you could do while I'm getting our dinner ready. I raked the leaves into a heap by the hedge to stop the wind from blowing it apart. After dinner, I washed up the dishes. I spent the night in Hazel's spare bedroom. It wasn't that she didn't want help. She let me help. I ran errands for her, picked up art supplies and groceries. On days she had been painting for a long time, she let me rub her neck and shoulders. I have good, firm hands. Shortly before Thanksgiving, I moved out of the spare bedroom, across the hall, into the main bedroom and Hazel's bed. I watched her face this morning as she slept. I stared at the shapes her lips make when she sleeps. The creeping sunlight touched her face, and she opened her eyes and stared at me, and she smiled. You know what I never asked, she said, is what about you? What would you wish for if I asked what your three wishes were? I thought for a moment. I put my arm around her, and she snuggled her head into my shoulder. It's okay, I told her. I'm good. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author of short fiction, novels, comic books, and films, Neil Gaiman. He was joined in conversation by author Michael Chabon. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature Stanford Professor of Education Linda Darling-Tammond. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.